Let us consider what is better to know until now. We know that Judaism is a traditional society, in a sense that everything of importance is derived from the past. Everything of authority is relied on precedent. Everything of spiritual importance is based in one way or another on the foundations of the past. That is, if you want to introduce a new idea, you have to connect it to the traditional world in one way or another. Although, from time to time, there is new voice, which is not only based on tradition, but it is introducing something that we haven't heard before. I've said time and again that the law and the halakha and tradition are the major avenues. But into that major avenue of consciousness, new triggers are being assembled. We said that in the mystical thinking of the first millennia, we have Sefer Yetzirah, Heichalotzi, and Heichalotzi. We know that in the beginning of the second millennia, we have Sefer Abahir and the early mystical thinking. Now, those things are having the avenues of oral law and written law. The oral law has people who are associated with. We know that this tradition is brought by that authority and this idea is associated with this teacher. Oral law has a very clear line of transmission. Written law may not have. I want you to consider a moment the intricacy, dialectical intricacy of written law and oral law. While you transmit oral law, you always have to say who said it, in whose name do you give it, under which authority do you introduce it. The people who transmit the oral law, whether halakhic or mystical, are always introducing it by so said this and that. Those are the teaching of that teacher and that teacher. Now, when you write, you may use another technique. When you write, you not necessarily have to introduce it by a name. You may introduce it as interpretation of a verse. And if it is an interpretation, or if it is a midrash, you don't have to say who is the authority behind it. So we have two ways of introducing ideas within the traditional world. One is based on personal historical evidence. Now it might be fictitious, and yet it is ascribed to somebody. It is belonging to a certain time and place and school. The other one doesn't have a historical framework. It has a sort of knowledge transmitted from heaven, or knowledge transmitted by time, or knowledge transmitted without a historical framework. In both we find very creative ways of thinking. We have to understand that there are numerous avenues of creativity. Some of them are concise, some of them are huge. The things that we talk so far about are not huge in their time. Sefer Yetzirah is number of pages. Sefer Abahir is number of pages, not very many. You can see the text without the course, without the interpretation. The text of Sefer Abahir is a very small text. When we come to the new stage that we are going to talk about today, something new is happening. We have 2,400 pages of the Zohar. If we publish it in a book, in a normal size, we have a volume, not one volume of course, it's a number of volumes, of 1,400 pages. Now we have to ask, where does that come from? Where is that body of knowledge? Where is it all of a sudden? I mean, just statistically, mathematically. If before you had 3 pages of Sefer Yetzirah, 50 pages of Sefer Abahir, let's be generous and say 50 pages of early Kabbalah, what we've been talking yesterday about, how come we have the jump to 2,400 pages? What do you need for that kind of accumulative knowledge? What do you need for that? In order to be able to produce that much quantity, what do you need for that? Try to say, what do you need for that?
A lot of people writing.
Well, that's one possibility. A lot of people write. However, are you familiar of many books which are a group work? A book. I'm not talking on a profound anthology. I'm talking on a book. Do we know many books that group of people write? Not really, not very many. Most books, when you catalogize a book, it has an author, sometimes two authors, but no more than that. We have when we start to consider the problem around this build-up, we have to start by the fact that it's a voluminous collection of 2,400 pages. In order to write something in that excessive quantity, you need to have either very strong art, very desperate art, or a great deal of inspiration. Just think about it, even today, with all easy technology, think how much time it takes you to write two pages. How much thinking, reading, time, exploring, availability of books, how much? Think of 2,400 pages. Somebody was writing and writing and writing in endlessly, with some kind of a drawing or some kind of an art, which has to have a conflict. What's the question?
Any famous writer, Lev Tolstoy, who wrote Anna Karenina and the War and Peace, so you'll get much more pages.
Why? What did he have that others didn't?
That was some kind of news, but it doesn't make it.
Yes, that's exactly it. He had some kind of an inspiration, some kind of a muse, some kind of a genius talent that enabled me to transcend the usual capacity. Let's say I'll give you 6 years. Can you write Anna Karenina?
Newsman
cannot write Anna Karenina, but okay, now here is the second question. Not only that the book of the girl is really huge, it's voluminous, but it's the only book in the mystical library that receives canonicity. Canonicity, that is a sacred position, which really shared only by two other books, the Bible and the Talmud. But those two have different ways, because canonicity could reflect a particular high evaluation of something. We call it a canonical book because it reflects something which is in the center of our consciousness, something that we believe, something that we revere, something that we ascribe an exclusive position. Now, the Bible has such an exclusive position because in the Jewish tradition it has divine origin and it reflects ancient past. The Talmud and the Mishnah have canonical traditions but of different kinds. What's the canonical tradition of the Mishnah and the Talmud? They are curricular canonicity. We have to study them in what we use in the traditional world. Every male member of the Jewish community has to be introduced into the study of the Mishnah and the Talmud as a canonical curriculum. You have to be able to make yourself familiar to some extent with the Mishnah and the Talmud in order to be a member in this cultural community, in this identity community. Nobody claims that it has a kind of a holy spirit in the sense that the Bible has, but it has committing position. So it's a matter of authority, it's a matter of exclusivity, it's a matter of curriculum. Now where does the Zohar come from? Does it have a curricular canonicity? Does it have a divine canonicity? Does it have a judicial canonicity? We have to remember that all of a sudden, out of the blue, a book of 2,400 pages is introduced in the last quarter of the last decade of the Spanish Jewish community in the 13th century. The last quarter of the 13th century, we are speaking on something where the Zohar starts to be present, to affect, to be part of the dialogue and the discourse. And we need to remember, as I said, that this is a book that receives a canonical place. There are more or less, when one makes a librarian cataloging list of Kabbalistic books, one can, until the end of the 18th century, I'm not talking on the modern period, but until the end of the 18th century, more or less we have 400 titles. Only two of those books, among the 400 titles, received an exclusive canonical positions. One is the Zohar and one is Ephraim. Ephraim is the Lurianic text that was written by Chaim Vital in the end of the 16th century. The Zohar was ascribed to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai in the end of the 13th century. The other 400 books which were written, many of them are very interesting and very thought-provoking, none received a canonical position. It means nobody treated them as a holy book, nobody treated them as committing curricular book, nobody treated them as a foundation of judicial consideration. The Zohar has been Hevel Yetzirah is not a canonical book in a sense that you don't judge according to it, you don't have to study it in the curriculum, you don't use it as a precedent for judicial issues, you don't make everybody to study it. It's not part of everybody's life. The Zohar gave such a position more than any other book. Hevel Yetzirah was highly revered, but it was not canonical, it wasn't sacred in this sense. Not really. I mean, it wasn't canonical in the sense that it's Zohar. It was very important, but if you say Sefer Yetzirah and say Zohar, they stand on a different degree of reverence and canonicity. Okay?
Yes.
I can't hear you. I hope that you can hear me better than I can hear you.
How quickly did it enter canonicity? How quickly was it accepted from publication?
Very soon. Very soon. Within the time of its first public appearance, it has been treated by the Kabbalistic circles in Spain as a divine revelation, as something that hasn't been such before. Now, how a book gained such a situation? Now, it doesn't mean that it was unanimously accepted immediately, but there were certain circles who were eager enough to make it the center of study, of thinking, of adoption, and all kinds of things which usual books don't perceive. But now we have to ask why this book received such an extraordinary position. It starts by the fact that it has an extraordinary author, and an author that paved the way for the canonicity of this book. It's not an incident. It is a carefully thought project that has been worked out in a way that people would wait for it and make it a celebration when it would appear, and being able to be convinced that it is ancient, it is hidden, it is mysterious, it is divine. Now you need a lot of talent for doing that. You need a lot of thoughtful framework of mind, and you need a community. You need a textual community where such a book can make such a place. Now, they had in Spain, in the last third of the 13th century, numerous reasons that enabled them to be part of such a textual community. First of all, they had the earlier ideas that we talked about yesterday and the day before yesterday. They had the idea that there are hidden dimensions of existence. To start with that, there are hidden dimensions of existence. There is a hidden dimension of divinity. There is a hidden dimension of the human soul. There is a hidden dimension of the textual world. But all of this has been worked out very well in the first half of the 13th century. The second half of the 13th century is taking those notions one step further and making it into a whole world within an exoteric circle and not esoteric circle. So we want to consider the problem of esotericism and esotericism. Esotericism, both words are from Greek. Esotericism takes inside, secretly, with small circles. Esoteric is something that only you know. Esoteric, like exit, outside. The extra is outside. The knowledge now is available of outside, not inside. The book is looking like that. The book is looking for the outside community, while here it was only like that. It was limited to certain circles. Here here it was approaching a different company. But the building blocks of what the Zohar has been doing are well made in the beginning of the century. The Zohar is like an ocean where the mystical ideas of the end of the 12th century and the beginning of the 13th century are pouring in. What is that they are trying to do? What is that they are working on? If we remember what we talked about yesterday, we would understand what is being emerging here. The esoteric of the first half of the 13th century is about the tragic life of the divinity, about the tragedy of a harmed divine throne, of a shattered divine temple, of a desperate situation where human help is highly sought and highly needed and required and commanded. The ideas between the new reciprocal relations between heaven and earth is what the esoteric Kabbalistic traditions have. They are telling us something about the deity that we didn't know before. We didn't know before that the heavenly temple is broken, that the heavenly seat is broken, that the divine is harmed, all that we have heard. It is tragic in its notion. It is desperate, and yet, in spite or because of this tragic perception of the heavenly world, the human role has changed tremendously. It's the humans who are asked to come to heaven. That thing in the background, enlarging the role of what we call dualism. Dualism is, if there is someone who is very much shattered and battered and harmed, there is someone who is shattering and harmed and battered. The active agent in this dualism is not the divine. The active agent is the one that we called yesterday Amalek, the one that very soon will be called Samael, the one that will be called Satan, the one that will be called very soon Israel. Very much that those different dimensions of the evil power, of the one who took over the heavenly temple, the divine throne, the throne, the deity and all that, all of them have been developed and infused with power in the writings of the esoteric circles of the early 13th century and end of the 13th century. They kept it secret. They didn't want to tell much about it. It was too much of an innovation. It was too much of a frightful idea. However, what they demanded people to do was what we call here Tfilah v'Kavanah, prayer with intention. Prayer intending to restitution, to build together the shattered heavenly temple, to put, to unite together the separated powers of the divinity. The human role here to assist the divorced deity was the conclusion of the perception of the upper part of the spot and of the animal. We have to understand when we say dualism in this aspect, the evil powers have the upper hand, and we said it is associated with the Christianity, with the Crusaders, with the conquering of Jerusalem, with the new seat of David by the Crusaders, all of them. Their response is, we are coming to the battle to help the good powers, the divine powers, as against the evil powers. The entity that was the major substance of this meditation, of this help, of this prayer, is the what we call the world of spirit. The deity is divided to the transcendent world of the infinite and the relatively revealed world of the same spirit. The prayers are intended to unify, to draw together the different broken and divorced parts of the 10-tier divine body. On Tfilah, because Tfilah is the active role where we're supposed to do this act of unification. When we say the word of the Tfilah, and you intend to do, to put together, to unify the three upper ones, the three lower ones, combine them all together, you add a level of consciousness in this prayer in a very systematic way. Well, now that's what the Zohar will do. The Zohar will add that to the Torah. What we have from here, from the first half of the 13th century, is Sodot Tefillah, Sod Hashem HaMeforash, Sod HaMenorah. We have small Sodot, the secret of the ineffable name, the secret of the seventh candelabra, the secret of the prayer. That's the way they're talking about. They're connecting the life of prayer with mystical meditation of the unifications of the broken part of the divine world. Now, as I said, their idea is expressed in numerous bodies of metaphor. Sometimes when they talk on the temple, they would talk on the Shachar temple, on the Shachar throne in the temple, on the Merkava that has been falling, on the hand of God that is falling. And it's the human action which is recruited to heaven. As I said, they keep it secret. They don't engage many people. They engage only those who have been recruited from their childhood to be ascetic, to be ascetic, to be drushim, nevirim, nevi'im, those students who have been dedicated in the yeshivot of Narbon, Kostier, Lumen, to those particular spiritual communities. There weren't many, but there were enough to produce very interesting literature and new spiritual ferment. The students of those people who wrote Sodat Tefillah, Sodat Menorah, Sodat Shema Mekorah, the students of those people took those ideas to Castilia, to Spain, and they started to inaugurate small circles of people who are thinking of it, who are thinking of it, who are working on it. In Castilia, some people lost control on the esoteric thing. They started to teach it why. In Castilia, the next stage of thinking is where we call Ha'afim HaKohanim, the brothers, Ha'afim HaKohanim, Ha'afim HaKohanim, the Kohanim brothers, who were developing their part. They were interested in what they called Ha'afilut HaSmali, the left emanation, the emanation of the evil power. They are looking in detail to the world of the evil, and they are telling us where it is coming from and what is its shape and how did it happen and what is it seems that it is corroborating those things. They start to work in detail on those parts, less than on this part. Those who work here on the prayer, on the intention, are interested in the active role of the human in helping. Those who are interested in the evil side gaining power are interested to understand the sources of evil, how does it come. It has mystical taste to it, it has dualistic taste to it, but basically, as I say, it is a projection of exile and redemption. Exile on earth is projected to the animosity and satanic power of the Tikra Achra, Samael, Amalek, and so on and so forth, and the hope for restitution, redemption, final solution to the problem is focused here on the right side of the prayer, of the sanctity, of the meditation and unification. All that has been going on in the first part of the church. Now we are going to the 18th and 19th of the 13th century, to the area of Guadalajara, Girona, Andalusia, Catalonia, different places in Spain where different circles of Mekubalim are studying, are writing, are thinking. They have all this. They have Sefer Yetzirah, they have Sefer Avadir, they have mystical treaties, they have the dualistic stuff. But some of them say, let's play a little different. Let's change doctrine. Instead of perceiving the deity as fallen, as shattered, as desperate, let's think on it entirely on the other way around. We will perceive the entirety of the Godhead as an active power, as a wonderful, creative, eternal power, and there is certainly evil dimensions in life or in history or possibly in the godliness, but it must be overpowering things. It is the other way around. So we can call those circles the pessimistic circles. Now we should remember, please, not to judge them. They are responding to the crusade. They are responding to the falling of Jerusalem in the hands of the crusaders. They are responding to the tragedy of their brothers being killed in the communities of the Iranians in the course of the crusade. They are living the Holocaust of their time, but not in the middle of it, but in the border of it. The crusades are not going through for them, they are going through the Iranians. But they are closely associated with what's going on in the Christian world, in the Jewish world, in the devastation. They are responding to a tragic situation by projecting the situation in heaven and reflecting the fact that the evil powers are heading the other way. Towards the end of the century, the 13th century Spain, a new circle of people is forming out a different answer. They say something like this. If I would be asked, what is the innovation of the Zohar, I would answer the following sentence. It is the anthropomorphization of the deity and the deification of the human. I'll explain. Anthropomorphization, this is ascribing human traits to the deity in a most profound way. The most profound human dimensions are being projected onto the deity and vice versa. The most desired divine properties are being projected on the human experience. So they are doing something new. Instead of stressing the desperate situation where human and God alike are rather helpless in line with the upper hand of the evil force, they are saying the other way around. Both are empowered tremendously. Both are understood in an entirely new way. What is God in this new perception? God is divided to infinite divine power, which is beyond our perception. It's called infinite, Ein Sof. First division is that God is depicted as endless, infinite. Infinite power, infinite existence, infinite eternity, infinite, infinite, infinite. Like absolutely omnipotent with no limits of end. No, Ein Sof is from the Bahir, but the idea in the Zohar is different. I want to explain what's the difference. The infinite perception of God, first and foremost now, is to express that there is an omnipotent dimension in the deity, which is unharmed. As against the Castilian, Provençal Kabbalah, which says that the deity is harmed. They start by saying, we divide the deity to two dimensions. One is the infinite. Infinite as infinite power, infinite time, infinite existence, infinite and beyond human touch. Nothing could affect this infinite power. However, this infinite power, overwhelming, powerful, abundant, blessing and so on, is infused into this world. That's the paradoxical contention. They say, disregard for a moment existence as it seems. Concentrate on the endless blessing of the divine unity infused in every dimension of existence. Now what are those dimensions? They call them the following names. They call them wisdom. They call them intelligence. They call them love and mercy. They call them power. They call them compassion. They call them lasting endurance, majesty, foundation, kingdom. All of those dimensions are the names of the spheres, but each one of them is either or something that humans and God are sharing, or something that humans are desiring. Each one of the spheres is a dimension of the divine life shared by human desire or human experience or human property. God is depicted in an anthropomorphic way, because let's say, when we say Chokhmah, Chokhmah is one of the upper spheres. When we say chokma, wisdom, wisdom is something that we either have, covet, or share. Wisdom is a value of humankind. We don't know if God has wisdom, nor do we know anything what God has or hasn't. We know what we have. We value wisdom, thus we would project wisdom as a divine property. We covet intelligence. Thus, Bina, intelligence, would be one of the names of the dimensions of the divine. We appreciate love and mercy. We know it's necessary for human existence. Thus, love and mercy is a name of the divine here. We know that compassion is a necessity. We project compassion on the divinity. We wish to share with eternity. We don't have eternity, however, we wish to share with it. For humans, the way to share with eternity is by their progeny, by the fact that they procreate, by the fact that they have children. That's the human way to share with eternity. That's the reason, as you recall, that angels are not supposed to share in procreation because they are eternal beings. Humans are not eternal by their biological constitution, but they are able to take part in the eternal existence in the spiritual way by wisdom and intelligence, and in the physical way by procreation. The other tefila is called foundation, yesod. But foundation is the name of all the creative powers which are associated with the sexual procreation, reproduction. It's the living force. It's what we would call the eros, if you wish. It is the power of life. It is the procreation, recreation, reproduction, all that ensure continuity of life. This particular dimension is called Yesod. It is called Tzaddik. It is called Shabbat. And it has all kinds of applications. But each one of those spheres has something that humans need urgently, and the divine is the pattern of it. To that I call anthropomorphization of the deity. But it's not my suggestion, it is their suggestion, because they call this huge, fantastic new perception of the deity. They call it Adam Kadmon Lekol Kdumin, primordial man of all primordiality, if you wish, if I may translate it like that. Adam Kadmon Lekol Kdumin, primordial man to all primordiality. That's the deity, which is the Adam Kadmon, which is the primordial man to all primordiality. So what do? They engender a new perception of the divine as a tremendous anthropos. Anthropos in the most meaningful way, not as a physical way. As a human being in its entirety, in its fear, in its power, in its love, in its compassion, in its wisdom, all the traits, all what we're calling Ether Tzvirot or Tzvirot, are all profound human traits or human properties or human desires. Each one of them. But they are guaranteed by the divine artistry there. So at the same time, we can share each one of those 10 properties. And they are the divine dimensions of self-revelation. In a way, Kabbalah is telling us that human and divine are the same thing, only in difference in size and continuity. The Adam as we know it, the human being as we know it, is like a microcosmos of the divine huge macrocosmos. Macro is big, micro is little, yeah. The divine macrocosmos, or the divine macro-anthropos, is reflected in the human micro-anthropos. They are sharing the whole thing.
Olam gadol,
olam katan, exactly. Olam gadol, olam katan. Yeah, microcosmos, macrocosmos, olam gadol, olam katan. However, now, it is connected in numerous ways. That's the point that they are making now. This perception that I was trying to explain, that there is a very profound connection between all human dimensions of existence and the divine dimensions of self-revelation and creation, is the thing that they are inaugurating in the end of the 13th century. There is a hope there. There is a difference there. It's not only human fragility and human torture and human persecutions, which are abundant. Of course, there is no lack of that. But, they say, we also share in the divine properties, which are constituted, I now read the names of the 10 spheres, Keter, Supreme Crown, Chokmah, Wisdom, Bina, intelligence of God, Chesed, love or mercy of God, Gvura, or Din, power of God, chiefly manifested as the power of stern judgment and punishment, Rachamim, or compassion of God, Netzach, the lasting endurance of God, or eternity, Hod, the majesty of God, Yesod, the basis or foundation of all active forces in God, and Malchut. Malchut is the last one. That's the one who is called Kingdom of God, or Shekhinah, or Knesset Israel, or the seat of David, or Malchut Beit David. All of what we have heard before. But now, all of that is a reflection of the divine being in its creative powers, which is reflected also in the human being. We all share that. So the interesting thing that they start the work is, we start by anthropomorphization of the deity, in the sense that the deity has all those human properties, but humans have all these divine powers. Both of them are sharing creative force. Both of them are sharing eternal capacity, spiritual eternal capacity. Both of them are sharing endurance, wisdom, compassion. Both of them also share the gvura, or din, or harsh judgment, misery, power, atrocity. It's also part of human experience. We cannot deny it. Either we share it as passive agents, or either we share it as aggressive agents. But what we call din, or power, or forces, is the way that they accommodate for all that. Do you see? While the Kabbalah of the divine took this force, this evil side, the din or the gvura or the animosity, they enlarged it and made it into a whole world of its own. The Kabbalah at the end of the 13th century will say, no, it's not a whole evil of its own. It's part of human experience. Just as much as we have other nine components, we have also this tenth one. We don't have only that. When you read the treatise about Amalek, sometimes you forget there is something which is not Amalek. Like, in a way, when you contemplate on exile, you may very easily forget that there are other aspects of life which are not exile, even when you live in exile, right? Even if you live in exile, You may be engaged in working, studying, raising family. You know, it might be very hard from time to time, but still there are spans of existence which are not only absolutely evil. It could be entirely evil, but there are, might be, not entirely. So what they try here in the new exoteric Zohar Kabbalistic way of thinking is to do this meaningful complexity of the human experience. As I said, love and belong, the co-creation and the eternity and the fear of death, all of them is there. They take the whole entire spectrum of human experience and they project it on this. But at the same time, they take the most complicated things from the deity and they project it on the human side. So they're doing anthropomorphization and we may say deification. In a sense, they ascribe human with divine power just as much as they project human experience on the divine force. We start from the second, as I said, now it is different. Now we have to understand how it applies. They take the old perception of Taryagnik, what would be more fundamental than that. We have 613 commandments, and they say, as against those 613 commandments, the deity is divided to 613 limbs, if you wish. So that the human body is also divided into 613 limbs, you know, about it.
It was
however, all of those things have been said one way or another, when they were not composed of it. Now they say that we have 613 portions of the Merkabah. They say, or 613 portions of the divine will, which are divided to the 10 spheres and to the reflections of the spheres. They are so fundamental, but the principle is that something in heaven is divided to 613 dimensions. We have, as humans, 613 limbs. You know, we have Abarim, and that's a modern song, Remat, Gidim, Shatagim, Remat, whatever. We have 613 limbs. And we have 613 commands in God.
I have a sentence of women.
Excuse me?
You know the women don't.
What do you mean?
I know it's the issue, but the Gemara actually talks about women and says that they don't have the same number of women. That's why when we say they should have more women, we don't. They should have started out. We say the whole day about that other people, because they don't have the same number.
Okay.
I'm sorry to make you,
I mean,
something else.
Let's say that if we make access to the 612 that we share, we would be in a new position. Let's say that we need one, but 613 is the general number of. It's the general idea. Now, the point of interest for us is not the number, but the connection. The idea that the deity is divided in the same division that we are divided, in the same commandment that we are supposed to participate in their execution, and we are told that the world is connected in a very profound way. Everything in the human body is a reflection of the upper divine life. Everything in the upper divine life is corresponding to something in the human body and in the way that the human body is recruited to on your neck. You do something upward and vice versa. From upward, you can move downward. For then, we are the marionette maybe, but when we move also something in the upper structure where the marionettes are tied and manipulated and affected. As I said, it's only a metaphor, not necessarily a good one, but it's something that we can imagine and understand the way that the other thing, it is the connection, the interesting connection between every human being, every human property, every human intellectual capacity, with every commandment, with every dimension of the being. Such entirety has never been introduced before. It infused human life with new perspective. Whatever you do is part of the divine ongoing life. It's part of a new perception of the textual basis of the commandment. Because while you study, you also do the same. You are participating in the intricacies of the divine world and reflected in the text. Because the next thing, after they introduce this idea, they say that the holy text, the scripture, is the divine unfolding in man. For then the connection to all those three is not mere physical connection. It's the lingual connection where the language is divine and we know from separate life. Where the language is a reflection of the divine being unfolding in the text while it is unfolding in the world. If the Zohar does anything, it is this endless wheel of intricacy of every dimension of human and divine life. The creative process through the sphere is reflected in the scriptures. The scriptures in turn are divided into commandments. The commandments are what we're supposed to participate actively in. When we participate actively in, we affect the divine world and like this and like that. In a way, it's a little bit like, you know, when you see the news and those huge things of the DNA, I don't know how you say it, Sharsharot HaGenim, those long, how do you say it? Yeah, like the gene chain. When you see something which is very complicated and connected to that, something like that is behind the perception of the endless chain intricacy of the world, or like the great chain of being. Uniting together the spiritual and the corporal, the divine and the human, the action and the thinking. It is all connected. It is this unique perception which informs it and makes it magnificently new and engaging for the truth. That's all I'm saying. Yes. No, I don't ignore nothing, but they put it in a new place. Now they say, yeah, they would say that the father is part of what is going on in the relations between Chesed and Ruach. In the body, it has a reflection that way between one part and another part. No, Ruach is the source where a certain part fell or left and becomes the Sifa. But the Sifa Akha is part of the evil which is in essence a part of life, of the intricacy of human experience, which is also projected on the world. Now, a great deal of this literature is busy with the speculation why there has to be evil. How come that there is evil in him later on, much developed in the Dorianic world? However, we must always remember it all starts from the human. We experience in our life the different perceptions and expressions of evil. We cannot account to all of them. We cannot rationalize all of them. We fully, presently, accept that evil factor is part of human experience, whether incidental, deliberate, inevitable, starting with death in various forms of death, diseases, aggressions, wars, and so on. We know that that's part of human experience. And the power we know is always effective. So the dramatic power in for the success in all their repercussions are also easy, are also part of the entire system. The part is that now they are not the only, they are part of those human. here they were much stronger. So there are Kabbalists who are taking this much stronger thing, who are pursuing that. We call them the Kubalei Kastilia, Kuba Astilutasmali, delayed emanation circles. However, the major body of the Zohar, we should view the entire existence as a reflection of the divine language through the 10 dimensions of the spheres, which are reflected in the human experience and in the divine experience. Okay, if we understand so far, let us reflect a moment on the question, how should one address? And I want to make a brief comment on the following. Since we are talking on a huge amount of material, one cannot aspire to say that there is only one way to relate to it. There are different systems that one may approach it. One can approach it historically. When was it written and why? Under what circumstances? One can approach it phenomenologically. What is the major phenomenon that is reflected in this literature? One can approach it philologically. What is the nature of the language, of the particular language that this new library of the Zohar is familiarizing itself with or is introducing itself to us? All those questions are very worthwhile and are very valid, and they may produce contradicting answers. However, my point is that when you have like a huge mountain of knowledge, there is not only one course of approaching it. Like when you see a huge mountain, you can say, you know, you can ascend here, you can descend from there, you can enter here, you can circumvent it. The same is with scholarship. These 400 books, 400 volumes of Kabbalistic literature are huge amounts of writing, huge amounts of thinking. One can approach it from this way, from that way, from this way. It tries not to be exclusive and to say that there is only one way to approach it. However, one should remember that this library reflects centuries of thinking, centuries of writing, centuries of living existence, which is reflected in the literature. And one may well ask, what is the question which is of interest to me as a reader? What is the question that was interesting for them as writers? What did they want to say? What is that I want to know? When you write, when you're going to write your paper, you should ask exactly those questions. What did the authors of any respective writing wanted to say, and what I, the new reader, want to know? What is it that I want to ask? Remember, all questions are legitimate. However, not every text can answer any question. One may definitely ask such a question. Is this huge new literature reflect new mystical experience? Is that huge literature reflect new lingual achievement? Does it indicate incorporation of new intellectual attitudes? Does it indicate a mystical first-hand experience? Does it reflect a fight against philosophy? All that might be very well part of the answer. Each question is perfectly legitimate. It is wise to say that the question which I am interested in is not the only question of relevance. It's not the only question of importance. It is wise to realize that the greater literature is, the more questions it raises, and the more answers it may offer. Now, not necessarily all answers are true, but all questions are. All questions are relevant. All ways to approach such a huge body of literature are absolutely legitimate. Answers may vary. Some are intelligent and convincing, some are less intelligent, some are captivating, some are less, but all questions are right, and modesty is really very good method when you have such a huge amount of material to say that you have one key to open it. Oh, it is really wrong. To think that there are numerous ways to address it is wise. Choosing a particular way doesn't mean that your particular course is the only one, is the right one, saying that others are wrong. No, so think that we have a good job. When you choose a certain course of addressing it, it doesn't mean that that's the only course. It means that that's the course you are interested in, but it doesn't mean that that's the only way to approach it. And I make this point now when we approach to this mystical writing, which reflects a whole new world that we know very much on as far as textual evidence, but very little on as far as the way it has been written. The psychology that inaugurated it, the mystical experience that facilitated it, the society that adapted it. Because this is entirely new way of thinking, of living. Now it's not only some secrets which are the interest of some esoteric circles of highly educated people. Now it has been introduced in broader things, and it's introduced something unknown before. Sometimes I think that that may be the greatest innovation. It introduces playfulness. It teaches us how to read text in a very playful, creative way. We haven't been taught that before. There is not a grain of humor in Heychalot literature. There is not a moment of laugh in Sefer Yetzirah or in Sefer Hagadot. They are very serene. They are
curious.
They are very curious. They are composed. They are structured. The Zohar, on the contrary, is not composed. It's not structured. It's not serene. It's not serious. It is rather playful. In a way, if I would need a metaphor to say how the Zohar has been written, I would say somebody decided to drive, let's say, along Manhattan in first gear and to stop on every pebble, on every stone, on every sidewalk and say, aha, I haven't seen that before. Now, can you imagine just to go very, very slowly on every word of the text and to say, let's play with it, okay? They take the text, scriptures, let's say, Genesis, Ruth, Shira Shirim, and they say, now we are driving in first gear. There is no acceleration. We are going to play with every word, to explore all the possible spiritual meanings of every word, to dig into that, to play with that, to play with words. They are saying, let us play and see what is the divine word behind it. If you recall yesterday, I told you that mysticism is characterized by the fact that it ascribes mysterious level to every dimension of life. They claim that behind the literal level there is a mysterious level. Behind the chat, behind the literal level of the text, there is a hidden divine level. They claim that behind history as existence there is a divine meta-history that makes things to work. They claim that behind the physical life of human beings there is an intricate life of the soul, which transcends the life of the body and precedes the life of the body. They claim that behind every dimension of human life there is a hidden divine dimension. The Zohar takes those principles that I just now said and starts to work into every word. They take the idea that the text is the unfolding of the divine language and it's upon humans through playful reading to discover what is the secret behind. They are exploring secrets in a very lively, playful way. Now, how serious they are, as serious as players are. Did you ever see a bunch of kids playing D&D? Do you know D&D? Do you know how serious it is? When they play D&D, they are all into the game. In a sense, the people of the Zohar are playing Dungeons and Dragons. And if anyone don't know that, it's too bad, you should know. They are playing Dungeons and Dragons. However, their dungeons and their dragons are according to the myth of the scriptures. Only they want to find the dungeons where things are hidden, the dragons where things are endangered, the things that are behind the text. They are setting up to find what's behind it all. They are playing with it, and at the same time, they are doing something which is very far from them. They realize that the only place where Jews have and always had total freedom is the textual exploration, what later on would be called hermeneutics. They are claiming complete freedom of hermeneutics in the sacred text, because for them sacred is a text that has infinite dimensions of meaning. Sacred is something that refuses any plain interpretative method. Sacred is something which reflects the infinite divine creative power meeting the infinite human interpretative power. So it's the creative divine power as reflected in the world and in the language, and the creative human power as reflected in endless intellectual capacities of the sacrament of playful hermeneutics, which is doing the meeting place of them. Now the word Zohar means splendor, means light, but it also means והמשכילים יסבירו כזוהר הרפיע ומצליחי הרבים וכוכבים. That's a verse. והמשכילים, the erudite ones, will be illuminated as the light, as the splendor of the heavens. המשכילים יסבירו כזוהר הרפיע. Those who are studying, interpreting, exploring, playing, they are those who are meeting the divine creative power through the human intellectual deciphering interpretative capacity. That's exactly what they are doing. They find that the human and the divine are meeting themselves in the interpretative spirit and in the creative spirit. Now, they do all kinds of things, and they are interested in all kinds of questions, but they may be entirely playful. Let me give you an example. They say, Shoshana. What is a Shoshana? Do you know Shoshana? What is a Shoshana?
Rose.
Rose. You know, Shoshana is a flower. Well, before that, before you give a Zerahani, Shoshana, what is Shoshana? Shoshana is Shoshana. Shoshana is a flower, right? Okay. Versus Stein says, a rose is a rose is a rose is a rose, right? But before versus Stein says that, the Kabbalist says, what is Shoshana? שמשתנה, now this is an interesting answer. משתנה in Hebrew is that it's transformed. That's a beautiful answer. Nobody else before said, מה זה שושנה? שמשתנה. If שושנה, of course in Hebrew, the משתנה has the root of שין נון הי, but שושנה has the שין נון הי. Of course this is no etymology, this is no grammatical answer. It's a game, it's a etymological game. Like you can say that you can להריח את הירח, you can smell the moon. In Hebrew, להריח, to smell, and the moon, ירח, share certain sounds. They say that you may smell the moon as להריח את הירח. Of course it has no grammatical foundation. Of course it has no classical etymological veracity. However, it has playful enlargement of the language. That's what they are doing. They are celebrating, and I say celebrating, the freedom of association, of interpretation, of exploration of the ancient text. They are playing midrash, okay? They are dorash. They are exploring all possible meanings of every word. They don't have a structural agenda. They don't know in the beginning of the evening where they would find themselves at the end of it. They don't come to teach theosophy. They don't come to teach theology. They don't come to teach words. They are playing with words, believing that the playful process of interpretation has a divine dimension. They believe that what they are playing in the unexpected avenue of exploration is an expression of divine inspiration. They are exploring lingual combinations, the unexpected ones, the unknown ones, and they say, okay, now we have been illuminated to this new dimension of the world, let's continue. מה זה שושנה? שמשתנה. אם היא משתנה, we should ask, who is the one which is משתנה? Which entity can we ascribe as transformative? Naturally, we would choose the שכינה. The שכינה is the שושנה שמשתנה. Now we would ask, what is its changing form? It is משתנה, it is changing form, good and evil, exile and redemption. life as we want it, life as we are afraid of it, they would start out to play with all kinds of possibilities, with the idea of transformation. You remember there is some angel which is said somewhere about המלאך הגואל אותי, המשתנה, something, something, that would be המשתנה מזכר לנקבה. They would be interested in transformation of androgynic kind, of historical kind, of grammatical kind. As soon as they start, מה זה שושנה שמשתנה? The very playful chain of associations of transformation is very rich. It is analogy. Okay, so we say they are reading the text in first gear. They are stopping on every word. They are playing the of absolute infinite possibilities of reading within the word. And at the end of the day they will say, this word is the expression of the sphere compassion. That word is the expression of the sphere wisdom. That word is the expression of the sphere Shabbat. They would play with all the possible meanings of every word without being committed to the sentence. They are involved in destructuralism. They are deconstructing the language. They are reading it, as I say, first year, word, stop, word, stop. They are pondering into every word and exploring what are all the possible ways of reading it. And by doing so, they find all kinds of wonderful things. And in their memory, there is the whole entire biblical scripture, the whole entire Mishnah, the whole entire Talmud, the whole entire Midrashim, the whole entire Kabbalistic literature before them. And they take all those possibilities and play with them. They are trying to do combinations of unknown sorts. For instance, let's take a word, Shabbat Vayinachesh. Shabbat, you know, Shabbat Vayinachesh, usually we think, you know, Shabbat, not to wait, right, to stop. However, they say, my Vayinachesh, Mishon Nefesh. Shabbat is the place where Nefesh, soul, is the source of. If you want to talk on him, what? And then say, many things that Rashon is.
What makes
you nothing much other than the inventiveness of it and the sheer fact. You read the page of Zohar and you decide what makes
it.
Well, however, it's not only that. Of course, as I said, their association is no less richer than ours. If you know from the Gemara, they also know from the Gemara. Right. But what do they do? What did Gemara says after they say Shabbat? Now they add, they take something from Sefer Abbasis. In the Bahir we know that there is Ilan Nechashot, or Ilan Nechamot. There is a tree of thought. They take the tree of thought from the Bahir, the Shabbat Vayinachesh from the Gemara. They are talking about something new about Nefashot, about Nishamot. Now we start to explore where those Nefashot are coming from, where they are going to, how it's going to be transformed from one to another, which is the sphere which is responsible on Nishamot. It's like 100 questions on every word. Recording all the sources of Jewish literature, of course, they are working with literature, they are working with language, they are working with knowledge. Only they are playing with consistency. And they ask, what is it all about? Now, if it's a game means a trust, a plot, a leader. In the game of the Zohar, there is a plan which says something of the following. We are in the time of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his followers. End of first century, beginning of second century. We are. The play is going on. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his contemporaries are strolling on the field, are walking from one place to another. They said they are never in a room, they are never in a study house, they are playing outside. They are also playing in the field. While they are playing in the field, they are meeting people. And they say, oh, very interesting. What is this person that we see now? This guy has a donkey. What does the word donkey mean in Hebrew? Hamor. So they say, Hamor, that means homer, that means matter. Now what is the matter, what is the field, they are using the plot of a group of people falling around in the field, meeting unexpected things like a fisherman, like a person who has a dog. They say, what does it mean? They use the world as a mirror invested with mysterious meaning, and they are exploring this mysterious meaning. The thing which is different is they are taking everything, experience, story, scripture, law, they are taking everything which, you know, just around the world, and they ask, what does it mean? What does it signify? Where does it take us? And this big factor of a group of people playing with words, deciphering the mystery, try to understand how those mysteries are connected to the ten spheres and the hidden life of the deity, is what constitutes the story of the Zohar. There are numerous little stories there, but the major story is that there is a person who is a channel, who is a pillar between the heavenly wisdom and the earthly knowledge. This person is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who is like a moon, a pillar, Ohad Kamcha Shekol HaOlam Nismach La, a pillar that a whole world is standing on. What is that the whole world is standing on? He is a man who is a bridge between past, present and future. He can see the future, he knows the past, he knows the divine mystery. He shares with his students and his followers the mysteries of the knowledge that are revealed to him. Shimon Bar Yochai is the channel of mysterious understanding. He is not depicted as playful, he is the source of knowledge. All the others are playing with this knowledge and they are implying it on everything. Yes, okay. Which is not playful and which is not thin, it just gives us a glance what a Zohar Perush is. What do they do? Okay, we'll read together a page and we'll see what does it offer us. And then we'll say it's mystical. What does it mean?
Thank you.
could you please read for us aloud where starts the ritual performed by the high priest? We'll read it quickly until I tell you to read a little slower.
I have been taught the Holy Spirit before the Lord shall be for me. Leviticus 16:30 says, quote, from all your sins, so what is the point of adding before the Lord? But the Isaac said it means actually before the Lord, written forth from the first day of the month the books are opened and the judges begin to judge. Every day the court is busy themselves with the work of judging until the day that is called the ninth of the month. On that day the judgments all sent to the master of judgment, and the supernal throne of mercy is prepared for the holy king. On that day Israel below must rejoice that they are to meet their Creator, who is ready to seat himself for them on the morrow on the holy throne of mercy, the throne of benevolence. All books that open before him in which all their sins are written, he will pray to them and cleanse them of them all. This is the meaning of from all your sins before the Lord, you shall be cleansed actually before the Lord.
Until here it's just a regular kind of a text with no exception, right? Okay. This is the verse. I choose it because it is Vayikra, because Alan is speaking Vayikra, so I said I'll give you an example of a mystical reading of one verse in Vayikra. Until here, that would have been part of anything. Okay. Please go on.
Those who say this verse stop here and proceed know that no one is permitted to say, quote, you shall be clean, quote, except for the high priest who has performed the ritual and made a bond with the holy name with his mouth. And once the bond is made and sanctified by his mouth, the voice descends and touches him, and the world is illuminated in the mouth of the priest, and he says, you shall be clean. He performs the ritual and all the upper forces that
recollection, it's not a halachic what has to be done. It is what? It is taking the listener to beyond time and place, where things have eternal existence, where history doesn't matter, where things of importance have eternal existence regardless to the fact of time and place. A good story does it for us. If when we are engaged in a story, when we read a story, whether religious or secular, a good story is taking us to a place where there are no borders of time and place. We are there. We are cast into the story. The story is taking us, and this is, I think, a beautiful example, of a situation where the constraint of history matters none, while the internal truth is the only ruler, is the only hero of the story. Now what does it tell us? The high priest, with all his brothers the priests, are performing a very sacred thing. Where is it going to? To Kodesh HaKodeshim. What does he see?
He
hears. What does he hear? He hears the Kruvim. What the Kruvim are doing. They are mating. It is said here, if you look on the second or third line of page 223, he burns the incense offering, the sound of their wings subside, and they cleave together, it said in the note, in intercourse, in silence. He sees something that nobody else saw before. He says something that doesn't have a textual proof. It is not part of Mishnah Yoma. It's not part of the Gemara. It certainly... Yes, of course. That's exactly where it takes. They're exactly... That's the proof that's offered. However, the whole thing... Yes. Well, however, here there is no recollection of a tragedy. There is no destruction of a temple. There is no past-present recollection of what once upon a time. You remember when the page that you mentioned in the Gemara, "Shenichnesu goyim leichal," that is in the past tense. That once upon a time, so it has been. It's a historical record of a horrible moment. But here, that's false history. It's beyond time and place. The Zohar takes every verse in the Bible or every verse in the Mishnah and retell them like it is an ongoing reality, regardless of time and place. He's not describing the past. He is in eternal presence. He is in eternal present perfect. For him, the temple is on. The priests are on. The high priest is entering. The cherubim are united. The blessing is going on. Only they are doing it by reading and playing and reciting and telling stories. They are eternifying or perpetuating Jewish life in spite of what's going on outside. They don't deal with the tragedy as their predecessors do. They are not interested in the catastrophe and the crisis on earth or in heaven. They are interested in the new era where everything is possible beyond time and place. That's the nature of redemption offered in the Zohar. They are speaking as if nothing has destroyed. They are pretending as if the temple is on, the priesthood is on, the biblical world is on, the Mishnah world is on. They're not bothered with history. They are meta-history. They say that everything that Holy Scripture says and everything the Mishnah and the Talmud and the Midrash say are all working on a present, perfect, eternal situation where there is no end to anything and there is no beginning to anything. It's all one continuum where things can go ever and ever and ever. History cannot put a hand in the meta-historical world. Nobody can contaminate the heavenly shrine of that time where the high priest is seeing the Kruvim. They are transcending borders of time and place. As far as I am concerned, mysticism is about transcending borders of time and place. you may do it in various avenues. You can do it by mystical eruption, you can do it by intellectual exploration, you can do it by narrative power. But you are transcending borders of time and place. You are not afraid of the paradoxical contention that the high priest in the Zohar is entering the Holy of Holies, which has been destroyed for 1,300 years. There is no problem there. There is an ongoing present perfect situation which would withdraw forever and ever, which would continue forever and ever.
It seems to me that the Mishnah was indicating that that's also true. The Mishnah was written, I mean, it was written after the temple as well, that the difference is the kind of assertion of he pleaded to the eternal place, the idea of the Christian intervene, that in the kind of perpetual present is not anything different than the Mishnah, but it's the added.
But what is
the
different? Why this is not a Mishnah? The Mishnah.
So they're playing on the Mishnah, but
yes.
They're adding these hints towards a supernatural element.
Yes, that's the definition. They are playing on the textual available previous structure, and they add to it a new dimension that hasn't been there before. It is quite right that the proof text of the story is a Kruvim Me'orim Zebazeh. It's quite right the Mishnah Yoma is the proof text of the general thing. Of course it's Leviticus with the Kohen Gadol Yom Kippur, which is in the... But they take all of that and they are retelling in a new way. Remember, history and story are closely associated. This is a story-oriented history. They are not committed to any historical truth. They are committed to eternal spiritual truth. The binding of rational proof, historical circumstances, constraints of possibility, availability, precedent, places, all that doesn't stand here. They transcend all those borders and make all religious heritage beaming with this beautiful new narrative which are being taught and re-narrated and introducing new narratives, and they're doing it on every verse of the Bible. All what they need is one word. They are retelling the whole biblical heritage with the Mishnah, with the Talmud, with the Midrashim. They are retelling it in such a way that it is a living being. It's a living heritage. It's not closed books. It's a living heritage in this perpetual present situation. Yes, sir.
But does someone also
okay, the Zohar has... we start by saying the Zohar has more or less 2,400 pages. In those 2,400 pages, there is room for nearly everything. There is poetry, there is law, there is narrative, there is playfulness, there is hermeneutics, everything is there. But all is not withstanding any laws that other texts would respond to. The Zohar does not present itself as a halakhic authority, no. When it has a commandment that it is working with, it says what he thinks how it should be. You know what's the halakhic rule about the halakha of the Zohar? If it is corroborated by other sources, it would be introduced. If it is contradicting any other halakhic source, it would not be introduced. So David ibn Zimra in 16th century was elaborated. But the point is that you can find in the Zohar anything you want. You can find in it some halakhic insight as the commandments would be. No, but you can take anything off it and say, well, this is an imaginary literature. This is a literature which does not work according to rational distinctions of time and place, and previous and later, and authoritative and non-authoritative. The only authoritative source in the Zohar is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. But now we have to pay attention to that. The whole Zohar is an invented path. This is no Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai of the Mishnah. This is a Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai that has been invented by the author of the Zohar. This is the Mishnah as has been reinvented by the author of the Zohar. But this is the creative power of this literature. They are well aware of all what has been available before. But they redo it. They retell it in a different way. What do they do? First is pseudo-epigraphy, and then there is pseudo-history, we may say. The person that apparently wrote this book is called Moshe de Leon. Moshe de Leon from Guadalajara, a place in Spain that is like the valley of certain rivers, where students of mystical texts were associated together. He was associated with Yosef Gicatilia, who was a prolific Kabbalistic writer. He was associated with the Barcelona Circle, Ezra Gabriel, and Ramban in one way or another. But he took all of those previous writers, and he decided the only way to keep Judaism alive is to take all what has been going on until now and redo it in a new way of reading. Not as against. He's not against anything. He's not against Mishnah, Halakha, or Midrash. No, of course not. He just doesn't want to say that all creativity had stopped in the past. He says creativity as a divine option is an ongoing thing. Every generation should contribute to the creative agency of receiving the tradition, reworking the tradition, reshaping the tradition in a most inspired way. He doesn't ask for halakhic authority. He knows very well that we have Talmud and Mishnah. But he says that other than the Talmudic law, other than the Mishnahic law, there is the inner life of the textual heritage. In a way, he says what Thomas Mann said in the beginning of Joseph and his Brothers. In Hebrew it says, Amukai be'er he'avah. Deep is the well of the past. And it's so deep because it reflects the whole entire human fear and human desire and human aspiration and human terror. And we would add, and divine reflections of all of it, and sacred texts of all of it. He's sort of jumping into the well of the past. And he's coming back with his recension of the past. Like, you can say, why do we need Thomas Mann to retell us Joseph and his brother? It's all written in the Bible. We know the story of Joseph and his brother. It has been retold in the Midrash. It has been retold. Why do we need Thomas Mann to retell us Joseph and his brother? For the same reason that his Zohar has an urge to retell the whole entire biblical library. Because they say that receiving the past is not just reciting it or freezing it or noting on it. It is recreating it. Knowing, studying, interpreting is also recreating. In order to keep things alive, you have to open the way to address it in various ways, not only in one way. They address it in a different way. They are playing with it, they are rewriting it, they are retelling it. They say mystical inspiration can have the complete freedom to read everything as they understand. Now sometimes this freedom could be very close to the traditional line. Other times it would be entirely unknown. The next stage would be, and that's the interesting thing, when the Zohar is writing a whole new text, the next generation that we're going to talk about next week is going to take this Zohar as a source of inspiration and reword it as a living divine voice speaking within the new mystic. The Zohar is taking the Holy Scripture and rewrite it as a narrative, as a play word, as hermeneutical ways, as laws, as poetry. They do this, they take the whole thing and say, we rewrite it, we replay with it. We are using pseudo-epigraphy so we can say whatever we want on account of older authorities. We are using pseudo-history so we can invent and shape the past as we understand it should be read. The next generation would take those ideas and would say, and we are now relive the voices of the Zohar. What the Zohar has in writing, now we are re-uttering in words. We are taking the biblical word through the Zohar, we are taking the Midrashic word through the Zohar, and we are taking it as a new divine living word. The Zohar caused the reinvention of prophecy. The Zohar was the bridge between ancient prophetic Jewish literature to new prophecy. see in the end of the Middle Ages. The Zohar, with its open channels and open avenues of freedom and interpretation, enabled the reinventing of prophetic divine word based on the Zoharic text. When Louis is prophesizing, when Caro is prophesizing, they are prophesizing the Zohar text. They are not prophesizing Bible, they are prophesizing Zohar. The Zohar had among its various stories and tellers and heroes numerous courses of opening other doors and avenues. Kabbalists took those avenues and reworked them. The Zohar had a plan, and I'll tell you about this plan next week when we meet, and we'll see how the other mystics would take this plan and would really work it out as a living force. All along the second millennium, the Zohar had a plan, a hidden plan, and the followers of it succeeded in it. I want all of you to read Sholem, chapters 5 and 6 of Major Trends on the Zohar, and consider carefully his approach, and try to read another scholar or another scholarship on the same issue. I want you to understand that there are numerous ways to address the problem. They are not mutually exclusive. The fact that you read it that way doesn't mean you can read it this way. In fact, such a library really requires multiple prayers for it. It's not what's right or wrong. It is so rich and it's so engaging. It could be addressed in numerous ways of action. Okay.